From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I am Hunter Deucing in the thought-out region of Dallas, Texas. And joining me in the Rocky Mountain High of Colorado is Mr. John Grace. Say hello, John.
Hello, everybody.
And joining us from his tent on Skid Row outside the Hotel Cecil, we've got Eric Zaldivar. Say hello, Eric.
Hello.
And joining us, fan favorite, returning guest, always a pleasure to have, the masshole himself, Mr. Garrow Nagosian.
Hey, I just want to let you guys know, when I was rewatching this movie that we're going to be doing, I actually streamed it on Facebook and Twitter. Can I actually play a clip of the stream?
Go ahead.
Okay.
Look at that
car. Okay, yeah, that's the clip for me watching the movie we're reviewing tonight, Mallrats.
Was that you, or was that Stu pretending to be you?
No, that was actually me.
That was Garrow pretending to be Stu, pretending to be Garrow. This is where we get meta.
Pretending to be Kevin Smith, crying while watching shit.
Oh, that's supposed to be Avengers Endgame.
Yeah.
Are you watching?
Is that,
that
the way he is now? Because I don't keep up with him. But is that?
Yeah,
that
apparently he cries for every movie.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
He cries.
Kevin, he'll post like a big, I just watched the new Star Wars movie, man. And he'll like post a selfie of him like welling up. He'll go, it's just the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. I'm telling you guys, it's the best. It's like he's Harry Knowles or something, where he has to come out and hype everything.
Jesus,
I think it's all that. All that soy he's eating is just estrogen just flowing through his veins.
You know,
you don't think he's getting paid?
It's very likely. But you know, I know. Look, and he had a heart attack, so good on him for losing weight. But he's like a hardcore vegan now, so.
Not the best way to lose weight.
No.
Not a top choice. I'm glad he lost it. I'm good. Everybody needs to, you know, get healthy, but that's not the best way to do it.
Right.
Now that I think about it, his audience has been reduced to nothing, so I can't imagine they actually pay him.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the studios still, there must be people on there who think he pulls some kind of weight in like Comic-Con circles or something.
Well, he doesn't. I mean, the studios don't really give him money. He gets independent investors, and then basically he goes out, he tours with the movies, you know, and basically charges, I think, like 30, 40 bucks to go see the movie, and you get a Q&A with him afterwards.
We're talking about his films. We're talking about, like, his critiques on
yeah, like, when he comes out and says, like, Avengers Endgame is bomb, like, you know, I just went and watched it at a private screening, and I'm crying right now, you know?
Yeah, I mean, he does have an audience of probably, like, a diehard fan base of probably about a million people.
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe that. I'd buy them. Yeah.
Sure. Okay, that makes sense. Sure.
But yeah, enough
he actually makes a great living. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I would admit. Yeah, he makes a comfy living as a niche kind of filmmaker. Although, you know, it's one of those things where over the years he's constantly talked about, I don't want to make movies anymore. I want to be a podcaster. Like, he wants to just podcast, because I think it's lower effort, it's easier money, and
everybody wants to be us.
Yeah,
that's all it is.
exactly.
And be the Midnight Movie Cowboys.
He listened to our show and he goes, yeah, these cats got it figured out. That's what he would say. Yeah. Cats, because he says cats. But he has recently started going back to the well. You know, he did the Jay and Silent Bob reboot. He's gone away from the well and then come back to it several times. And a movie he's talked about doing a sequel to next is the movie we're talking about today, which is Mallrats, which was known as his sophomore slump for a long time. I think today it's probably one of his better regarded movies. You know,
isn't that funny?
Yeah,
he was apologizing for it like a week after it bombed.
He said, I went to the Independent Spirit Awards and I wrote the show, and this was right after Mallrats, and I came out and I presented an award and I went, no, and I did Mallrats. Ooh, sorry about that. Like, it's a joke. And then when Roger Ebert reviewed Chasing Amy, he goes, the last film Kevin Smith did was was Mallrats, a movie so bad he felt the need to publicly apologize for it.
Yeah. And now nobody talks about Chasing Amy.
Well, yeah, and Chasing Amy, when I was in high school, you know, Chasing Amy was the one, when you'd listen to him talk about Mallrats, he'd go, oh, that movie, oh, yeah, oh, it was the one he talked about, like it was the redheaded stepchild. But Chasing Amy, that was my personal, my very special movie. It's my special child. It's my best film. It's the most personal film. It has a Criterion release, you know.
I have a theory as to why Mallrats has maybe become a little bit more popular now.
I do too, but I'd like to hear yours.
Well, then I would like you to follow mine, please.
Yes.
Okay, so Clerks was the, I guess, calling card movie, right?
Right.
Mallrats was the one and only time, at least in the VSQ universe, up until, always, because we can't consider Jersey Girl or any of that stuff VSQ. Mallrats is the only VSQ movie that actually attempts to reach a wide audience. This is just to be thrown to the masses, as opposed to Chasing Amy, which is another kind of calling card movie in a way, where it's the stand up and look at me movie to try to prove to the studios that he's more than just a dick and poop and fart joke or whatever guy. And then Dogma kind of focuses in on a smaller audience, and then by the time we get to Jay and Bob, he's already just basically, even though that was his most successful film up until that point, he's only playing to his audience at that point. It's a movie for the fans, essentially. Mallrats, I think it's the only time, at least in the first, where are we at now, five movies at this the point of Jay and Silent Bob?
Yeah, it was five.
First time that it was actually meant for like a wide audience as opposed to just a niche crowd.
I think so too, and I think that's a great analysis. And I think also you have to consider where Kevin is headspace wise, because Kevin, I saw this thing where he said that he said, and you guys will agree with this. This is actually very, clear-eyed self-critique. He said that he is a guy who is very influenced by other people's opinions. And he goes, I will have this idea and I will go, look at this baby I have created. I will hold it up and people will go, that sucks. And I'll pull out a gun and I'll say, you're right. Let's kill it. So
is he our first message board influenced director?
I think so.
Inspired director online guy.
He's the first guy it was the first time in a movie I ever noticed a filmmaker acknowledging Ain't It Cool News message boards. Because remember, he had that fake website in Jay and Bob, moviepoopshoot.com.
He was also the first, I think, director who had his own forum.
Yeah.
You know, because he had it on the Viewaskew website. He had his own forum where he interacted with his fans.
And I think with Mallrats, you know, he was riding high on the success of Clerks. You know, he said he met James Jax, who told him he said he wanted to pick up Clerks, but he wanted to remake it. He didn't want to release it because he wasn't going to release a movie with necrophilia. But he was interested in doing Kevin's next movie. And James Jax had just done Tombstone, I think. And he said he wants to do Clerks in a mall. So then he gets with Universal, and he's given access to the train set, as Orson Welles would say. and he gets to make his studio film. And, you know, that movie died a horrible death at the box office, you know, and when you see him talk, like, the intro on the Arrow Blu-ray is 12 minutes long. 11 of it is him talking about it dying at the box office.
And, you know, I'm pretty sure Clerks made more money than Mallrats
did
at the box office.
It
yeah.
did. He said that he wanted it to be like a $20 to $30 million Billy Madison type thing. And he said he remembered driving Joey Lauren Adams to the airport to go do Biodome. And he told her she was a moron and she was stupid for going to work with Pauly Shore. And that movie was going to tank. And, you know, she's better off doing stuff with him. And then he goes, that movie went to do the kind of business we wanted to do, $20 to $30 million.
Yeah.
He's like, so, you know, I'm an idiot. But but I think after Mallrats, Chasing Amy is a cynical, bitter movie. Made by a cynical, bitter guy, I think.
I think the first half of the movie, I think, is great.
Me too.
I think the first half is probably some of his best stuff, you know? And then the second half, except for the Jay and Silent Bob scene, is just deathly.
Oh, yeah. It's just, I don't know what abyss I was looking into, you know? But even, you know, high school me was like, this movie's weird and depressing. And, you know, like the last scene, you know, just was horrifying. And not the last scene, but the climactic scene where Ben Affleck suggests that they have a threesome.
It makes no fucking sense.
No, I remember thinking, even in high school, you know, me being stupid going, what is he talking about?
That's where the movie lost me in high school when I saw it. It was fine for me up until then. It's just like, how is this going to accomplish anything with the three of them? And that was just the comic book geek in him, you know, coming out. He couldn't help himself, I think. This guy, you know, who's obsessed with the idea of a threesome with his best friend and his girlfriend, his lesbian.
Well, I mean, is it unsurprising that, like, later on you found out that his wife would make him watch gay porn and then have sex with him? I mean, go from Chasing Amy to that, it's a straight line.
He's trying to tell us something back then. He was warning us. He was telling us this is the road he's going down.
And then, you know, but the one thing that was even more horrifying and just staring into the abyss was when Ben Affleck returned as Holden McNeil in Jay and Silent Bob Reboot to, like, I don't know, tell us about mansplaining or something. He gives this monologue where, and, you know, Joey Lauren Adams shows up again as her character, and it was watching a man who, you know, Ben Affleck, who was at a low in his career, sink even lower. But
this is not Buttman I know.
But yeah, yes. I so, but I think Mallrats had a little more joie de vivre, if you will. I think Kevin was in a more hopeful mindset, and because he's a guy who gets really down. He's one of these guys. I listen to his podcast fairly regularly, like 10 plus years ago, and he's one of those guys where he would get in a dark mindset for a while, and you could just tell that there was something wrong. You know.
You talking about fucking a vacuum cleaner or something?
No, it was just like a movie would fit. Well, like, okay, so I was listening to a show when Zach and Miri tanked at the box office, and which, and you listening up, leading up to that release, he was talking as though he had a sure thing on his hands. I've got Seth Rogen. I've got, you know, the Apatow crew. This is when they were in everything, and everything was making money hand over fist. And when this movie came out, his show got so dark, I stopped listening to it, because it was clear that, you know, he just it affected him.
He probably needed to take a break from podcasting for like 8 months or something.
Yeah, well, and that was around when Scott Mosier was going and working with other people. You know, he was.
No, oh, weird.
Yeah. What were you about to say?
What's funny is that basically he was expecting the movie to perform like a Judd Apatow movie, like over $100 million.
Yes.
But it ended up it ended up performing like a Kevin Smith movie and made about 30.
I guess he needs that affirmation that he's never gotten. Is Jay and Silent Bob the first one? Is that his only movie that's actually made money?
Well, I think
close. No, all of his movies have made money. Like Chasing Amy only cost, I think, like $250,000, and it made, I think, $7 million at the box office.
Yeah. All right. Well, let me rephrase what I said then. Like, he needs the affirmation of a $90 million. He's never had that in his life. Like his career doesn't even depend on it. So what does he care?
Yeah, I think his highest grossing movie might have been either Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back or Zach and Miri. It might have been one of those two.
I thought Zach and Miri bombed. I don't remember.
It made over 30. It made over 30 million, which is what his movies usually make.
Okay.
Yeah.
No,
but I think he was thinking Zach and Miri was going to be the thing that put him in that club of Apatow directors where he was going to be making big money.
He wanted knocked up money.
He did. And then he did Cop Out and he was like, oh, I'm going to direct a script I didn't write. You know, I'm going to do that. And, you know, that I think I listened to his podcast a little bit around when that happened and that tanked. And he's just, you know, he's a guy who, these successes and failures really affect him. And I think people talking crap about him on the internet affects him. Otherwise it wouldn't show up in his films.
If that's the case, you take off that stupid mask.
Yeah.
Okay. His highest grossing movie is Cop Out at $44 million.
What?
Weird. Wow.
Yep.
I would never guess.
Never would have so guessed weird. That. That and Yoga Hosers are the only movies of his I haven't seen.
And I think his second is Zach and Miri. Hold on, let me just check what Jersey Girl made. Because Jersey Girl might have low-key made $30 million.
It could have.
Nope, it's 25. So Zach and Miri is his second highest grossing movie, and Cop Out is his highest grossing.
Okay. Yeah, I remember Jersey Girl got caught up. That was one that got caught up in the Bennifer.
I haven't seen it since it came out in the theater. I liked it just fine when it was out.
I thought
it was
a fine little heartstring tugger. You know, it was fine.
Sure.
Didn't have any problems with it.
It might be better than 90% of his filmography, I'm sure.
Well, and I think – and that's another one where he's making a quote-unquote personal film. It's about being a dad, you know. Okay.
Sure.
You know, it's less degenerate than Chasing Amy, which was just about how dysfunctional his relationship was with Joey Lauren Adams, I think.
No. The Chasing Amy was about him being having a crush on the kind of lesbian filmmakers from Go Fish, that movie Go Fish.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Go Fish. Was that Allison? Who was that?
I'm not sure.
Go Fish, Rose Troche?
Yeah, Rose Troche.
And Guinevere Turner, okay?
Yeah, Guinevere Turner.
Yeah. She's the chick who wrote American Psycho script.
Mm.
Yeah,
because she was in his little orbit. Oh, that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, because he in Chasing Amy, he was still with Joey Lauren Adams.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was only afterwards that she cheated on him with Vince Vaughn.
Yeah, and I had heard that, you know, she was supposed to play, I don't know if it's for a fact, I just heard that she was supposed to be in Dogma.
Mm-hmm.
And David Klein, who is Kevin's cinematographer, who shot everything like Mallrats, Clerks, he shot Chasing Amy. I had heard that she and Joey, like David Klein said that they were both given the boot by Harvey Weinstein. Like they thought they were working on Dogma, and right before shooting, they found out they weren't or something. Mm-hmm. Because I know Kevin and Linda Florentino didn't get along,
yeah.
Yeah.
But you want to hear a funny story? Like, I actually had dinner with Kevin Smith right after Mallrats. He had finished shooting Chasing Amy. And basically he was with Joey at the time, because Joey Lauren Adams was with him. And basically he was bad mouthing swingers. And he just didn't like swingers. So I find it kind of funny that the star of Swingers stole his girlfriend.
Oh my gosh.
When he was saying this, Garrow was Joey Lauren Adams just kind of chewing gum and looking at him and nodding.
She's
and
like,
stuff.
Oh, yeah, it's got Vince Vaughn.
I don't think she had met Vince Vaughn yet because they did a movie together afterwards.
Yeah, they were in a Ricky Skaggs video or something, or Dwight Yoakam video together.
So basically, it might have happened a few months after I had dinner with both of them. But yeah, this was because he was at a college doing a talk, and a friend of mine, you know, Betsy Sherman, she knew him because she was a reviewer for the Boston Globe. She's like, hey, you want to go hang out with Kevin Smith? I'm like, yeah, sure, why not? So basically, it was like probably about 6 months before Chasing Amy came out when this happened.
He was like, yeah, Garrow, man, you know, this Swingers movie, it's about a bunch of actors, man. These cats, you know, they're trying to get work. I don't understand it, man. Where's the, people want to hear about comics, you know, where's Stan Lee? Where's the, you know?
Yeah, that was the thing about Mallrats was it's unique to actually, at the time, it's nothing now, was all the talk about comic books.
Yep.
You did not see that in a mainstream or attempting to be mainstream comedy, period.
And so circling back to just Mallrats, it came out in 1995.
Let's circle back around.
Let's circle back around. We're going to circle back around to that, you guys. Mm-hmm. So this was one that I remember when I was in middle school, like kids had the soundtrack in their CD wallet and they would have the poster. And I remember, so Garrow, John told me that you were like telling your boss to buy up this poster because you were like, this is going to sell big because it's a pretty eye-catching poster.
Yeah, because I worked at a poster store in Harvard Square or outside of Harvard Square called Pick's Poster Seller. And I remember me and John, I think me and you saw the movie early, am I right?
Yeah, we saw a preview screening.
Yeah. And I said to Ira, the guy who owns it, I said, it was hysterical. You gotta buy a shit ton of posters for the movie. It's gonna sell great because I was the one. I saw Reservoir Dogs at the Boston Film Festival, and I came back to him and I said, "You gotta buy Reservoir Dogs posters. This movie's gonna be fucking huge." And he listened to me, and Reservoir Dogs were like our top selling poster for like 10 years. And basically, he was like, "Oh, you were right about Reservoir Dogs. I gotta buy Mallrats posters." Mallrats comes out, tanks.
Yeah,
we have thousands of Mallrats posters and they're not selling. And then the movie comes out on VHS and all of a sudden it starts selling. Not only that, Kevin Smith is calling us up and buying posters from us wholesale because he needs to sell them too. And all of a sudden, those thousands of Mallrats posters that we had, gone.
Nice.
And I was vindicated.
Well, and Kevin Smith talked about the poster. It was drawn by Drew Struzan, the legendary poster artist who did like Star Wars and, the Green Mile and whatever else, you know, not the Green Mile. He didn't do that one. He did a version of that one, but, the thing, you know, so Kevin basically said that this is the design I want. I want it to look like a comic book. He and Scott Mosier sort of came up with the concept and then Drew Struzan designed it. But he said that, it would be up at bus stops and at places. And he said that he noticed that people were confused by it. They were thinking, is this a magazine? What is this? Because he said that he thought the poster kind of worked against it a little bit because people didn't know what they were looking at. He said people were going, is this a periodical? What am I looking at?
That's back when the poster mattered a little more than it does today. Now it doesn't. I don't know if movies have posters anymore.
It's just two big heads.
Yeah.
I remember Thomas Jane, he plays like a Drew Struzan type character in The Mist in the Frank Darabont film. And he goes, they could just, he has that storm break through his window and it ruins a poster. He goes, they'll probably just get a Photoshop one. Two big heads.
Yep. That's all anything is now. But yeah, posters. I could see that happening too, because first of all, the whole comic book reference thing is totally lost on the general public in 1995.
Yeah, yeah. It's
you think they don't read comic books now, but they go see the movies? Back then, they didn't read the comic books or go see the movies.
And
there's
no recognizable stars on it either. Jason Lee, this was the first. I mean, he'd been a featured extra in something. But this was the first movie he was really in. I mean, he was a skateboarder before this.
Yeah, you wouldn't know him unless you read Thrasher magazine.
Yeah, Shannon Doherty was a TV chick, but she's on
the
poster.
Brenda.
Yeah, and, you know, I think when I saw the poster when I was a kid, the only face I recognized was Stan Lee.
Yeah, he was the only... young Hunter.
Yes, I was. I went, I know who that is.
Collecting metal records and, yeah, and you knew Stan Lee.
But, you know, but I also saw it advertised in Marvel comic books.
Yes.
So that was another thing that spread awareness for me. But I was in, like, you know, fourth, fifth grade or whatever. I was not old enough to see this movie. So I saw the ad for it and I went, well, my parents aren't going to let me see that. It's rated R and move on, you know. So.
And they were right.
Yeah. but I didn't see this movie till it came out on DVD. That's where I first saw it.
Didn't see it on VHS.
I started kind of getting into Kevin Smith stuff. But Eric, what about you? Did you first see it on video?
Saw it on, I'm pretty sure it was a DVD. It was at a friend's house. He got me into Kevin Smith all within 1, 2, or 3 weeks, I want to say. It all kind of came at me fast. I think the first thing I ever saw was Jay and Bob Strike Back. So I didn't get half of the jokes.
Yeah, that's one. It's all in jokes.
Yeah. And then we moved on to, pretty much everything else except Clerks. So it was, Dogma, Chasing Amy. I saw on HBO years later. And then Mallrats and Dogma is what I saw during my indoctrination. And I had to catch Clerks on my own. I think I rented that from the store or something. I liked everything except for Clerks for some reason.
I think Clerks is his best film to this day.
Yeah, that's the popular opinion, definitely.
Yeah, yeah, because that one I feel is like the perfect representation of people in their late teens, early 20s in the 90s. Like that movie crystallizes it perfectly, you know, in Dead End Jobs and all that. The problem with Clerks too is that basically when they're in their 30s, they're not working at the same jobs they were in their early 20s. You know what I mean? They're right. Not still working shitty jobs. They have better jobs that are shitty. You know, it's just, I think that was the problem with Clerks too.
There are people out there that I know that have the same, or at least the same level shitty job for 20 years from their 20s all the way to their 30s and even 40s. But these are not people that you want to be celebrating in a movie.
Yeah.
I can't get behind, you know, Dante and Randall when they're 40 years old and working at movies, you know, at a fast food joint.
Well, no, that's Clerks 3 that's coming out that he's planning on shooting.
Wait, so. No, they're not working at movies at Clerks 2? I saw
No,
Clerks
they are
2.
At Clerks 2, yeah.
But in Clerks 3, they're going to still be clerks. That's
pathetic. Yeah.
They should be at a pawn shop and there's a robbery or something.
So they can do the original ending of Clerks where Dante gets shot.
And have like a Peckinpah type shooting at the end and totally throw the audience off.
He can't. He'd have
to get. Let's say suck it, crowdfunders.
Yeah, he'd have to get a guest director in. He's not going to be able to handle that.
Yeah, he can't. He can't shoot any action or anything involving tension or
he's gotta
movement.
Got to get Buddy Van Horn to come in and.
Charles Pickerney is going to come in and shoot the finale.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Let's get this cat, Buddy Van Horn, to come in and handle the action sequences. Comes highly recommended from
Robert Rodriguez. Yeah. Come in and shoot thing on a skateboard.
Yeah. Yeah. Robert Rodriguez is going to come in and
skateboard
explain.
A phone.
He's going to go, all right.
Robert Rodriguez pushes a button in his basement and the scene is done.
Yeah.
Robert Rodriguez.
Screen.
He's like, all right, Kevin, what you got to do is get in this wheelchair and I'm going to push it. You get the camera.
We're the blood on Randall is actually dyed guacamole.
We got the guacamole gun and it hits Dante in the face and he's dead.
Cool. Yeah.
Speaking of Clerks, have you been following the Lexi Alexander saga of her hating black and white movies except for Clerks on Twitter?
What?
God.
Oh.
That lunatic.
She's crazy. I mean, I don't understand how she made Punisher Warzone because that movie's awesome. You know,
because well, second unit.
Yeah, second. Yeah, you're right.
She was She was on Twitter bitching about black and white movies, and apparently some executive some time ago asked her, what's your favorite black and white movie, which seems like a very strange thing for some suit to ask. I don't think they'd care about that.
I don't think it happened.
Yeah, that's what my initial thought was. But she says, I only like Clerks. And she was just railing on black and white movies, that they're all racist and they're all this and that and they're all, they haven't dated well. And I responded with this coming from the person who made Punisher, which has more stereotypes than your average Charlie Chan programmer.
Yeah, all the Italians are like, hey, we're going to do Punisher like a meatball or something. Yeah, it's very stereotypical.
Hey, we got the Punisher. He's going to come in here.
The girl from Dexter. Play like Dexter's wife or whatever. She has like dyed black hair and she speaks in this terrible mook accent that's just laughable. I mean, I enjoy the movie because it's bonkers, but God, that performance and some of the other stereotypes, I think it'll drive
it's
you
not,
nuts.
Yeah, it's not even WAPS. It's also, you got like a Jamaican Rasta in there. It's just, it's, you know, acting as if he'd what you'd expect. Yeah, the movie's wall to wall stereotype.
You got Wayne Knight not being fat. Where's the fat representation?
Good Lord. It was like a Joel Silver production while Joel Silver was making cheap movies in Louisiana.
But circling back, guys. Circle back around to Mallrats. So, Eric, the reason we did this movie, I think, was because you brought it up.
Eric. Thanks a lot. This one.
Yeah.
No. I brought it up. I was curious. I hadn't seen it in almost 20 years, and I keep hearing all these things you've been talking about, where it's just like it's gotten reappraised as the best thing he's done, and I was just like, yeah, maybe. I remember enjoying it more or less, you know, back in 2001 or whenever the hell I watched it, and so I was like, okay, yeah, I'll be on. Well,
and it just came out on Arrow. Just put out a Blu-ray that has the original, the theatrical, the extended cut, and the TV cut. Which the TV cut is hilarious because Jason Mewes was too high to do his looping. So there's this obvious bad dubbing on Jay on all of his replacement dialogue. And it's quite amusing.
Watch that on YouTube if it's available.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure you can find some highlight reel or something. It's quite amusing. Anyway, go on about what you were saying about it's reappraised.
Oh, I don't know why. It's terrible.
So you hated it watching it again.
I didn't actively hate it. I just, there was no laughs. I think I didn't care for it at all. It has all the problems that you expect from a Smith movie. Some of these actors, you know, it's not his usual troupe of characters, his troupe of actors. You do have the Jason Lees in there, and you have all these guys that would go on to make films with him almost every single time that he makes a movie. But you have these actors who I don't think I've ever seen anything else, and I'm sure they're perfectly fine if they weren't in a Kevin Smith movie. But because they're in a Kevin Smith movie, that opening scene, I don't know, all that monologuing between the boyfriend and the girlfriend behind the car, all that stuff felt like the worst of Brian O'Halloran and the other guy from Clerks. That's one of the reasons why I don't even like Clerks. I can't get past how bad the acting is.
I do think it's funny that a girl died because he told her that the camera puts on a few extra pounds.
Mm-hmm. What was I going to say? But, you know, I'll say this, that I remember initially liking the Brody character 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And now I wouldn't want anything to do with a person like that. As an adult, it just seems like, what a degenerate. Like, yeah, no, no kidding, your girlfriend left you. You don't deserve the girl at the end. Fuck you. The world is a
loser. Oh, man. Yeah. I think Brody is, you know, he's the comic book. Did you guys ever know this dude in school? There would be the circle of nerds. And that, like, played D&D, played video games, you know, whatever. They were kind of outcast characters. But there would be one nerd among them who was the alpha, who was kind of a bully, who would treat the other ones like crap. And he was the alpha male nerd. And there would be the one, you know, decently attractive girl that would hang out with them. And that would be his girlfriend, right? And to me, Brody is like the sort of Jason Lee, the more handsome dating Shannon Doherty version of that type of person. That because he's very loud. He's a bully. He's braggadocious. He's a jerk to everybody. But he reminded me of that type of person because I definitely knew that type of person.
I knew that person. He was me.
Was it you and Mike Malloy? Were you?
we're 12 years apart. Oh. I had long hair at the time, so I guess I'd be the girlfriend.
They were playing D&D, and then you know they'd bully the other spaghetti Western fans. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I knew that person. It was me. I grew up. I didn't turn into Brody as an adult.
That's too bad. No, I'm kidding.
Not really. I'm okay. I saw what my future lay last night when you made me watch the film.
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
But yeah, I thought it was interesting because you were like, I can't imagine watching the extended cut.
The extended? No, I can't. It was.
I watched it. I had to watch it.
I don't. Like, what could there? I'm curious. What could there be?
Okay.
Oh my God.
There's so much. There's so much at the beginning of the movie that was cut out.
Yeah, they cut out an entire act, basically.
Yeah, Elizabeth Ashley's entire role was
the opening feels awkward, so it wouldn't surprise me if that's the case. So what did they cut out?
There's this whole thing between the London kid and Claire Forlani where he's trying to bang her on the roof, and he's wearing a Revolutionary War reenactment costume. And her hair gets caught in his flintlock rifle. I mean, I don't know what the hell he was thinking when he was writing this stuff. Like, this was going to get cut, right? And there's this stuff with Michael Rooker and Elizabeth Ashley's character. She's like a rich woman or the governor. I can't even remember now. And it's all the stuff they refer to throughout the film.
Yes.
There's some references still in the theatrical cut that make no sense. I think Garrow and I even talked about it, like, what were they talking about or something? And Garrow read, oh, he had to cut all this stuff out, and they still refer to it in the movie or the final
print. Is it all regulated to the beginning?
No.
Yes.
But there are several scenes where they refer to stuff. There's one where, you know, they're about to do the show, and the producers go, if this is anything like that crap at the governor's ball, you know, you're through. And then there's another bit where Brody, when he stink palms Brandy's dad, he goes, well, if it isn't my neighbor. because that makes zero sense, but it's a reference to something from the beginning.
Yeah, it's like Brody gets a camera crew to stick their camera in the window of the Michael Rooker character's home. And that's where you get the scene where he's doing boxing or whatever, and his towel falls down and shows his ass, but it's done like it's filmed for a TV news. It's weird. Like none of that really made much sense as it's happening. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't flow like something logically would in a slapstick comedy. It kind of shows Kevin Smith's inexperience.
I didn't consider depicting
that sort of thing.
I didn't consider any of this stuff to be references to something that they actually shot, because I'm just so used to it from Clerks referencing things that I'm supposed to know.
Right. Right.
You know. Walt Flanagan's dog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
You know, they there are all these little in jokes that you kind of, it's like reading the Talmud where you have to like go, oh, I connect this to this movie and I connect this to this thing. And oh, there's this interview where Kevin explains this and there's this. So, oh, okay, that's what Walt Flanagan's dog means.
And there had not been a comedy director like that before where everything was in this type of universe, like a Elmore Leonard novel or a Tarantino movie. You were kind of seeing the Tarantino universe kind of brought in the slapstick comedy.
And Smith said his big influence was John Hughes. And, you know, he even gets John Hughes's composer, Ira Newborn, to do this movie. But he said he was very influenced by John Hughes, and John Hughes doesn't tie characters together. It was just the high school, Shermer High School. You know, he has this common place where his movies are set. And I think Kevin took that and took comics like with crossover things and sort of put it together. I think that was kind of it. 'Cause he said that Mallrats, like he said, he wanted to make movies like Porky's or Weird Science or 16 Candles, stuff like that. He said that was, but where the people talk about the stuff he and his friends talk about, like comics and all that stuff.
So he's personalizing slob comedies is what he's doing.
Yes, okay. Exactly. He's making it more like, hey, it's what me and my friends talk about, you know. And,
right.
But Garrow, what do you think of this movie today when you watch it? Because I know it's kind of gone down in John and Eric's estimation.
Well, I loved it when it came out. I absolutely loved it. I thought it was great. I didn't like it as much as I liked it back in 1995. I feel that there is some atrociously bad acting in the movie. Mm. Atrociously. Jeremy London is fucking awful in the movie.
Yeah.
Awful. Awful. And I think, like, literally, I think basically Kevin has a problem with real actors. I like, for some reason, real actors can't say his dialogue. It's like literally inexperienced people kind of get his dialogue. Like, Jason Lee wasn't an actor, but Jason Lee is the best actor in the whole movie.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, you look at him, he's natural. Jason London or Jeremy London, I don't know which one it was. Yeah. Jeremy. They're like, literally, you can see them acting the entire time. Claire Fulorani, you can see her acting the entire time. That one, the Trish the Dish girl, see her acting the entire time. Literally, the best actors were, like, Jason Lee, Stan Lee, Jason Hughes, and they're not the real actors. And Ben Affleck was actually good in it because he's actually playing a Beantown Chad in the movie. Yeah.
No, I love that you said that about Jeremy London, because there's something you can tell when certain actors aren't being directed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're just sort of, because there's certain actors they need their director to push them in the right direction because they have tics. Jeremy London says every line like this. Oh yeah. Oh, okay. Okay. And then he puts his hand up on his face and looks around. He has this sort of incredulous way of delivering his lines, and he does it every time, and it's because he's not being told don't do that. Because there's certain actors, I notice it in, like, film class. There's certain students who will do things over and over, and you have to go, aha, you there's this thing you're doing. Don't, you know, you're doing that because it's something you fall back on, right? It's something you do because you don't know what else to do. And with Jeremy London, you can see that. A great example of this that I think everybody will agree with is Mark Wahlberg. All right.
Yes.
Every time Mark Wahlberg is in a bad movie, he kind of does this. Hey, guys, what are you doing? Hey.
Yay. Damn movie.
Every movie.
It's the,
like,
Terrence Hill effect.
Yeah. It just, like, Wahlberg, when he's being directed by a good director, he's fine.
Like Scorsese.
Yes.
Like Scorsese in The Departed, like, where he's fantastic.
Yeah. And then you have something like The Happening, where he's up talking. It's Mark Wahlberg talks to animals. Like, that whole skit is what Mark Wahlberg does when he's not being directed. You know? Yeah.
I will say that when I was watching it, I noticed how bad the acting was, and also that it's funny how the untrained actors are coming off better than the actors who've actually, you know, been to acting school or whatever the hell, you know. And I mentioned it to my wife, who has some experience in the film industry, and I said it's just something like I don't know if he's writing the wrong type of dialogue for actors. There's too many big words in one line of dialogue for an actor to say. I said it even looked like Ben Affleck was getting tripped up, at least in the extended cut, like saying all this lengthy dialogue. And she pointed out, she said he probably didn't have them rehearse.
Mm.
She said this is what something that Richard Linklater is very big on, is having his actors rehearse. They rehearse like crazy. And he says, I bet he did not have the actors rehearse, and that it does show when you're watching it. It almost looks like it's a first time practice run, you know.
But it's weird because Jason Lee comes off like Olivier in the movie, you know. Yeah. I mean, he is like, he's actually like you, it was you understand why it was a breakout role for him, because literally he's one of the few people in the movie who's acting as natural.
Because Kevin
right. knows he's yelling all his lines too, and yeah. kind of like he's dealing with the fact that they probably haven't rehearsed. So he's like, well, okay, I'll just be the loudest guy on the
well,
set.
Well, that's
it.
How you steal a
so
scene.
It comes off better. Yeah. Yes, exactly. It worked because he stole the movie. They had to basically, yep. I think, reshoot half, you know, a good bit of the film to make him the star.
And I think it's funny too that you say Stan Lee is one of the best. Kevin Smith said that James Jax was like friends with Stan Lee and gave him the script. He goes, "Well, I met with Stan Lee and I showed him the pages," and he was like, "Yeah." And he goes, "Yeah." He goes, "The problem," Stan said, "I would never say any of this shit." And he goes, "Stan Lee calls me and he says, yeah, you know," he goes, "the problem is you have me saying all this stuff about girls that got away." He goes, "If I have to go home to my wife, she sees that in the theater, she's going to be pissed." And he goes, "So why don't you put in a little thing where like I made it up?" and Kevin Smith goes, "Later I figured out that guy, he just figured out how to get himself an extra screen. He just gave himself more screen time."
But he was actually good at the movie. Stanley
was
actually
yeah. yeah. He was great.
Yeah, it's I've noticed Smith seems to have problems with real actors, and I'm not saying Linda Fiorentino or Bruce Willis are easy to work with, but a director should be able to work with them without, you know, he's always the one director they've all had problems with.
Yeah.
And I think he's just out of his league dealing with real experienced actors. He can't do it.
He works with his friends a lot. So like Affleck and Damon are his friends. So in something like Dogma, yeah. he can just let them go.
Right.
You know, they're going to do their thing. They probably rehearsed on their own, you know.
And they're filmmakers themselves, yes. and they kind of know what, you know, what to do and what not to do. Throw him off.
And it made me think of Good Will Hunting too, hunting season. So action, Gus, or what? Busy, Ben. He's counting his money. Gus Van Sant. Break a leg, guys. Get your hands off me. but Ben Affleck playing three roles. And what was it in Chan, Bob? But
I lost count. I actually lost count how many roles he was playing in that.
No, I wasn't with a hooker last night. But so in something like Dogma, he can just sort of let them go. Jason Mewes, you know, he said that the studio really wanted to recast that character with Seth Green or Brecken Meyer. And they basically made Jason compete for the part. And even when he got it, he had to sleep in Kevin Smith's hotel floor. Like, they weren't putting him up or anything. Because they were like, he's not an actor, you know. Like, we're just, you know, they basically, he got the part because Kevin just dug his heels in for him. But they wanted someone else for it. And Jason Mewes is going, he goes, "Yeah, man, when I did this movie, people were like, 'Wow, you're in two movies. How many cars do you got?' I said, 'Bro, I got 7 grand. That's it." But I don't know.
I was wondering, is that guy still alive? Is Jason Mewes still alive?
Yeah, he's still alive. You know, I think he does like Twitch streaming a lot now, I think.
Okay. But I'm sure that's fascinating.
Yeah. But he was just he just did you know, Jay and Bob reboot.
I forget that came out. I don't know anything that's happened with the Askew verse or whatever since Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. I haven't followed his career at all.
Yeah, you know.
And I didn't necessarily hate Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. I was amused by it in some parts. I guess Will Ferrell yelling was enough for me back then. But I just lost interest in... No, Cop Out. Cop Out was the last thing I saw, and after that, I didn't want to watch anything else he ever did.
Well, Clerks 2, I think, was the last legitimate stab for the View Askew universe. So, like, everything after... I mean, and Clerks 2 is not good, but everything else post that has been barely be considered a movie.
I did see Clerks 2. I saw Clerks 2 on DVD or something. I forgot I did, but I did see it.
Jay and Bob Reboot is barely a movie. And you know, when I watched Jay and Bob Reboot, I was going, all right, you know, I'm kind of enjoying this but then once Kevin Smith's daughter shows up, the movie just it becomes, you know, just unwatchable.
The nepotism askew verse.
Well, that's the thing, is like he wants to make a Mallrats sequel called Twilight of the Mallrats. And I just know
there's no moles. There's no moles. Yeah, where the hell is it going to take place?
I know it's just going to be another vehicle for his daughter, because that's the only reason he makes movies now. Because I remember
when Kevin go around and femsplain to every character from Mallrats.
Yeah, well, that's what Jay and Bob Reboot
is. Bitch-splain, you know?
That's what Jay and Bob Reboot is. We should almost do like a commentary for it or something. I mean, because it is like we do a feminist femsplain of the Isk universe. That's what that movie is. And it was really tough to watch because, you know, in like Jay and Bob Strike Back, it's a journey through the Isk universe. This one just isn't very fun. It could have been great because, you know, with Marvel movie hegemony, that could have been something to explore. And they do a little bit, but it just becomes a platform for Kev's daughter. And I'm sorry, but she's just not interesting. You know, she's just not somebody anybody wants to see. And I think the only reason he's still making movies is for her. I don't know what you think, Garrow, but it just. That's the vibe I get, because I remember he was talking for a long time. I don't want to make movies anymore. I just want to do podcasts, blah, 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 blah. And then when Yoga Hosers came out and that flopped and then he does this, I went, okay, maybe that's what's going on. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I don't know. I never saw Yoga Hosers. I couldn't bring myself
to
do.
That's one of the ones I've never seen.
Yeah, and it kind of pisses me off because everyone I know who's seen it has said it's fucking awful. And as you know, it got into Sundance, and that was the year that I got rejected from Sundance.
So what you're saying is Kevin Smith's daughter will be in Dangerous People 2.
Yes. Well, if there ever is a Dangerous People 2. Yeah.
Or Actress Apocalypse, the remake.
Yes. You know, but reboot, it's,
I think, is a fancy word now.
See, the year that, and everything that pisses me off about that year, because it was like Yoga Hosers and 31 got into Sundance that year. And I'm like, really? I got rejected for those two movies? Those two fucking movies?
Well, we know why that is, girl.
Yeah, because it's basically their names. Their names.
Yeah, exactly.
That's it. That's all it is. You know, that you can make it when it comes to film festivals. If you're a name, you can make the shittiest movie possible and they'll show it because the people will come see it just because they want to see the famous person.
Yeah.
I've seen Yoga Hosers or 15 minutes of it because that's all I could stomach. It was unwatchable. Unwatchable.
Oh, yeah. I'd be curious to see what you guys think of Jay and Silent Bob. Did you see Reboot, Garrow?
Yeah, I thought it was okay. It had like I'm grading it on a curve because I haven't liked anything he's made in over like 10 years, and this one actually had some laughs in it that made me go ha ha.
It does,
you know. And so I thought like half of the movie was cringy as all fuck, about, and then a quarter of it was, you know, okay, and then another quarter was, you know, relatively funny.
Yeah,
I saw it too.
Oh, you saw it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. What'd you think?
What do you think?
He hated it.
I didn't hate it. It was not good. Ironically, I liked not all of it at all, because her presence annoyed me. But there was a few moments that were sweet and tender between her and Jay, who plays her father in the movie. And I imagine that's, you know, Kevin knows how to write for a father now that he is one for the past, 20-something years. So there's some scenes with them that work for me. I saw this over a year ago, so I don't really remember all that much. I seem to recall Ben Affleck being okay in it, but you just tore him apart earlier in that role.
Watch the scene. It's one of those things where he sells the dialogue because he's Ben Affleck and he's a good actor.
Yeah.
But when you look at it in the context of everything they've done, it really is just like it's just him doing a woke, like,
okay,
re-examination.
I didn't pick up on that, mainly because I was just kind of thirsty for anything that would
believe me, I was the same way when I watched it, because I was going, the beginning of the movie, I actually was going, this is kind of tickling the Askew Universe feels I had in high school. But it just went away. And when I saw that scene, it took a second, but I went, did I just really see that? Did that just happen?
Yeah, well, I'm never going to watch it again, so I'll take your word for it. Yeah, Jason Mewes looks like, I don't know, the Crypt Keeper with dentures or something.
Man.
It looks.
Drugs have taken a toll on him. Let me tell you what. He looks way older.
It doesn't help that Jeff is young, but he's not an old guy. You know, he's in his 40s.
Yeah, but 40s kind of. I mean, actually, I think they're probably in closer to the 50 at this point.
Let's see. Jason Mewes.
You know, 40s is the new 70s for a drug addict.
He's 46 years old, so you're right, Garrow. He's not too far off. But, if he cut his hair and didn't dress like he's, 19, I think he would be okay. But those fake teeth, I don't know.
And Kevin Smith actually is 50. He was born in 1970. So,
yeah.
Jay's a little younger. And I don't know, but, I'm glad Kevin's lost weight. But skinny Silent Bob is weird.
Yeah,
it's just weird. I don't know. But I watched Kevin introducing the extended cut of Mallrats, which him introducing the extended cut was him just talking about how terrible it is. he was so fat, and this was like 15 years ago. And I was going, man, wow. I forgot how big he was. Before he
is this around the time where he couldn't fit on the plane or something like
this
that?
This was before that. This was before that. This was about 5 years before that. 5 years before that.
He yo-yoed on his weight a bit in the 90s because I think he lost weight when he was with Joey Lauren Adams, and then he
regained it when Vince Vaughn stole her.
Yeah, exactly. He was stress eating.
That opening scene in Dragged Across Concrete, not Dragged Across Concrete, Sprawl in Cell Block 99 was like when Kevin found out Joey Lauren Adams was cheating on him. He just starts punching the car.
instead of punching the car, it was like an all-you-can-eat buffet.
Yeah, he was like hitting like a Jersey Mike subs or something.
They were like, okay, like S. Craig Zoller's like, all right, Vince, I want you to put yourself in the headspace of Kevin Smith. With Joey Lauren,
that's why. Wait a minute! I'm not going to eat on camera. What are you talking about?
Like, what are you talking about? I lost weight for this role. I got really cut, Craig.
I can eat like that. God, the guy looks at ice cream. He gains weight.
What are you talking about? I got really cut for this. Drudge is going to run a story about it.
Kevin admitted on camera to Men's Fitness or some magazine that he would drink a gallon of milk a day. I don't even think that's true. It can't be true. How can somebody drink a gallon? Why would you do that in the first place?
I can't drink a glass of milk.
I knew a guy who did it. A friend of mine did that. It was to gain weight. He was a small guy. And he did it to like...
I'm drinking milk because I want to smoke up. When I go to the conventions, I want to wrestle people.
Do a claw on them, But it wasn't him. It was another Hispanic friend of mine. he was trying to gain weight or gain muscle, but he ended up getting kidney stones because of all the calcium. So he quit doing that shit. Then he switched to beer, and I guess he felt better about himself.
I don't know how anyone can drink milk outside of like cereal. Like that's the only time I have milk is when I'm eating cereal, and
have it with like a protein shake, and that's about it. I can't drink straight milk.
Yeah,
no,
that's
me neither. No, I need it with something else.
Why would you want a gallon of milk a day? I don't understand.
Hey, stress eating. Joey Lauren left him for the swingers guy, so he couldn't.
This is years later. Years.
He never got over it. The Zach and Mary bomb by his standards. It didn't make that Apatow money, so.
Her voice is that of an angel. You just can't get rid of it out of his head. The gallon of milk. I can't even drink a gallon of water.
Bruce Willis bullied him too much and fat shamed him, saying.
You know what? Bruce was right. He was right.
Yeah, he was. He was.
We've come to realize that now.
Yeah.
Bruce was right.
Well, I don't know. you know, I think as far as like Kevin's original run, cause, so like the original run of movies is like Clerks to
Jan Bob.
You know, that's kind of the original run of Kevin Smith stuff before he started going off in different directions. Yeah. Mallrats, you know, is probably the one that I watch the most. And, you know, Clerks is very 90s. I think you're absolutely right, Garrow, that it is. It's one of the defining sort of Gen X things with the soundtrack is also perfect, like with the Soul Asylum stuff. And
Soul Asylum, they sound like the Ramones.
Which I was surprised they weren't in, because they're in like all of his movies, but they're from Minnesota and they weren't in this, and it was shot in Minnesota.
Weird. It was probably a Universal thing. It was probably Universal Music or whatever.
Yeah, you know, the soundtrack for Mallrats is very like kind of mid-90s pop punk, you know, type stuff. But it's
At least the Goops are on there. They sound like the Ramones.
Yes.
The Goops.
But it's
sound like the Ramones.
It's probably the one that I enjoy, that I watch the most. It's a little more polished. It kind of has that it has a big 90s feel, and it has that sort of comic book pop culture before it became Cadillac'd by the mainstream.
Yeah, because Mallrats came out before Spider-Man, came out before Blade.
Yeah.
Came out before, I mean, literally the only comic book movies you had were like Blank Man and Meteor Man. I mean, that was it.
Tank Girl.
Yep.
And the Marvel was Dredd.
No, actually, Judge Dredd was after, so I think. No, it was before.
You had the Marvel attempts like The Punisher and all that in the late 80s.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, those were lower tier, but.
But I just. You know, there's something about it that kind of gives me that feel for that time, even though, you know, it's not very well acted. It's not very well put together. In fact, on the Arrow Blu-ray, you know, I was it looks so good. You're noticing all the little mistakes, like when Bob's on the roller skate and he flies through the women's store and all the underwear flies up in the air. You can see like hands tossing the underwear up. The Blu-ray looks amazing, but you notice all the mistakes. I could see the boom a few times, you know.
You know what struck me as odd? The breakup letter, which if you're there, why not just break up with him, and why do it in a letter? That already was kind of strange. But in the next scene when he's telling Jeremy London, TS, mm-hmm. About the breakup, he gives him a framed picture. Yeah. And you can't see it. He framed the letter. Yeah. Like, it's okay. Like, I understand from a character standpoint, he's hung up about it, but why wouldn't you have a close up of it so I can see what the hell it is? It looks like you're showing him a picture of your family or something.
You know,
bizarre.
And that's what's funny is when Kevin talked about the extended cut, he said, you know, one of the things they did when they made it was we went, oh, you know, that was the only movie that he and Scott didn't edit. They had a studio editor put it together, which good, because that movie was saved in editing if you watch the extended cut, because I don't think they would have put together a movie that flowed very well. Because when you see where they pulled footage from, it's from all these different scenes, and you know, you go, wow, the editor who put this together is actually really good. But he said that one of the reasons that it was a big waste of time was they didn't shoot a lot of coverage. And so when they shot a scene, they would shoot the actors and the stuff they knew they needed, but they didn't get anything extra, like a close-up of this, that, or the other thing to cut away to. You know,
because yeah, so when I saw that, I thought, and Garrow can speak to this too, that, you know, you have to make compromises sometimes, but it just seemed too often with this movie, and I just thought, this is just more Kevin Smith laziness.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've often talked about how Kevin Smith seems to be, he's kind of a lazy director. And that's why I think he doesn't want to be making movies.
He's certainly the poster child, numero uno person I can think of that is his career is right place, right time.
Oh, yeah. In fact, go ahead, Garrow. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you got to understand when Clerks came out, it was like everyone, and there were all these movies trying to be like represent like 90s Gen X kids, stuff like that. And all of them were kind of false. There was one with Steven Dorff called like SFW and shit like that. And they were all like these pretentious fucking movies.
You know what one of the worst was Reality Bites. I hated that movie.
Reality Bites.
Oh, I've never seen it.
No matter how awful you think Brody is in Mallrats, Ethan Hawke's character is worse.
Oh,
in 50, Reality Bites.
Yeah, Reality Bites is one of those movies that I hated because the Gen X characters were so despicable and the movie didn't know it.
Yep. But it was like Clerks came out and Clerks was like, it was unpretentious. That's why it was so good. It was funny, unpretentious, and it really represented, like, you know, because I was like working at a store and we would do the same shit at the store that they were doing in the movie. So we were kind of like, oh, finally a movie that kind of represented what we were dealing with at that time. And I don't know, it just kind of clicked, you know?
Yeah, I can understand.
And it's like, it's one of those like perfect movies from that era when you lived in that era. Do you know what I mean? Like maybe someone, you know, 20 years later might not connect with it like I did at the time, you know? And, but at that moment in time, Clerks was the movie about being in your late teens and early 20s.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. And I knew that was what the appeal was. Yeah, I was born in 87, so I missed all that. By the time I saw Clerks, it was early 2000s. I was in my teens. It didn't really click with me in that way. All I saw was just kind of this movie with awful dialogue and acting. But you know, I totally understand. Yeah, like I like of their time films. You know,
You get
a look into the zeitgeist of the time. That's why I'm surprised that so many people my age actually like the movie.
And you also got to understand that, like, in the 90s, comedies were a dead zone in America. There were hardly any funny fucking movies from the 90s, like barely any. I mean, unless you were watching movies from like Stephen Chow movies from Hong Kong. I mean, literally, you would go to the movies and most of the movies were just incredibly unfunny. And then Kevin Smith was actually like one of the few people actually making movies that I and a lot of people thought were funny in the 90s.
Right.
Yeah, Biodome was a big hit in the 90s. Keep that in mind.
Yeah, that's it's because
circle
nothing.
Back around to Pauly Shore. He had regular theatrical releases at the time.
Yeah, like Son-in-Law.
Son-in-Law.
Yeah, I'm looking at the 1994 comedy list. There's some movies here that people probably consider classics. The Mask, Dumb and Dumber, Junior.
Yeah, I'm Arnold and I'm pregnant. Yeah, it's funny. Pregnant. I'm a tough Austrian guy, but I have a uterus. It's funny.
Naked Gun 33 and a third, Baby's Day Out. I saw in the theater.
Oh,
Naked Gun
33.
Yeah. Naked Gun 33 and a third wasn't that good.
Yeah, it was running out of gas.
Baby's Day Out was a classic, though. That is the Citizen Kane of babies running around a city movies.
I saw that, and I saw Richie Rich in the theater.
Saw Richie Rich in the theater. Okay, the thing about Richie Rich, there's one line in that movie that I thought was hilarious, and that's when these kids are fencing. This was when Macaulay Culkin was in everything, and these kids are fencing, and one of them asks him if he wants to do some like rich kid, some like obscene rich kid activity, and he goes, "No thanks. My dad and I are going to Japan this afternoon for a hostile takeover."
Thank you, <dude. laughs> Another big comedy that year, The Flintstones. I saw that in the theater.
I saw that in the theater with
so
Kyle
did I,
MacLachlan.
Unfortunately.
I think I'm the only one who didn't see it then.
Wow. What else we got? Those movies were still going to cinema. They weren't going to tape. Ernest Goes to School was somehow playing the theaters.
So
that played in theaters, yeah.
Eric, was this when Doug Walker was going to the movies every weekend?
Hold on. There's a lit. Hunter, you and I saw this in the theater, not together, but a Blank Check.
Yes, Blank Check is my favorite Home Alone ripoff.
I have a beef with you, Hunter.
Oh, what?
You know how you were on that religious talk show? And you were talking about Christmas movies?
Yes.
And Blank Check.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a problem with you. You said that one of your favorite Christmas movies was Home Alone.
Yeah.
everyone knows Home Alone 2 is better for one reason.
It's got Donald Trump.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's got the Donald in it.
Up until Macaulay Culkin digitizes himself.
He shows up and goes, hey, down there and to the left. Looks into the camera and winks.
Yeah.
My wife had never seen Home Alone, and she goes, this kid's form of acting is just mugging the camera. That's all he does.
That's all he did do. Yeah.
He still does it. When he showed up on James Rolfe's channel, Eric, all he did was mug the camera.
I saw that. Yeah, it was not good. Yeah. He's been out of it for a long time, but it's not like his acting has changed.
No, it's the same.
All right, I'm kind of curious. Okay, Blank Man, the Hudsucker Proxy.
That's good. I like the Hudsucker Proxy.
The best comedy from that era was probably Don't Be a Menace to South Central while drinking your juice in the hood.
That's a great
movie.
Yeah,
that was funny.
That is a funny
That's
one.
Actually funny. You will laugh your head off watching that thing.
Ed Wood, 94.
Ed Wood is funny.
That's another one no one saw when it came out.
That's true. And it's his best movie.
Yeah.
Okay, Serial Mom. I wanted to bring up Serial Mom. Well, I didn't want to bring up Serial Mom. I wanted to bring up John Waters. I look at Kevin Smith as, I think, not the case anymore, but I used to really enjoy his one-man shows and his rock on tour stuff.
A night with Kevin Smith, an evening with Kevin Smith.
Yes.
That, when that came out, that was something my friends and I like loved on DVD. Like, we would share it with each other, go, oh man, you got to watch this, because we thought it was great. Like, his stories about Prince and Superman Returns. Like, it was great storytelling.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
It was fantastic. The story.
I liked him better. I liked him better than his movies, and I feel the same way about John Waters. But now I can't even watch that shit anymore or enjoy it because Kevin Smith is such a fucking knob today. I can't deal with him.
Well, and I he's done a lot of them since, but I don't want to see him because I know that that first evening with Kevin Smith was such lightning in a bottle that any since then, I just having listened to his podcast and who he is now, I just don't know. You know, I don't think.
I stopped. I listened to his podcast too, like 10 years ago. And then I'm just sick of him.
Yeah.
I kind of got to the point where I'm like, yeah, it kind of like how I got with Howard Stern. I'm just like, I don't want to listen to this guy anymore.
And do you remember Garo? Like, he had his podcast, Smodcast, right?
Yep.
But then he started doing spinoff show. And he had like 100 podcasts.
Yep.
That were on a million different topics, and it was just untenable. There was no way he could keep up with all of them. Like, he had one where it was just him and another director talking about stuff, which is cool. You know, that's a cool idea. But there would just be so many different themed spinoffs that it was impossible to keep up with and keep up with anything else.
Yeah, he had like 8 different shows with 8 different people, and it was just like, at the point you're just like, I don't have the time to listen to all these Kevin Smith podcasts. They're too many, you know? And then finally you just kind of hear the same stories over and over again.
Yeah.
And it's just like literally there was nothing new interesting happening with them. And then he became a pothead, and he became way less interesting when he started smoking pot.
Well, that's the thing is, to me, his movies got chronically uninteresting when he started smoking weed. Mm-hmm. Because I think Zack and Miri was the first movie I saw of his that I just completely hated when I saw it in the theater.
Well, he actually didn't smoke weed while making that movie.
Oh, I thought he did.
After. No, he actually was afterwards. Seth Rogen got him into weed after they had filmed the movie.
Oh, interesting. I thought it was during.
We know what a comedy genius Seth Rogen is.
Yeah, it's funny. Seth Rogen had a movie come out like earlier this year that went like straight to HBO Max, had made zero ripple. It was like Dangerous People. It had zero ripple when it was
American Pickle, I think, right?
Yeah. Like, you never heard anyone talking about it. You know, it was like HBO Max was like, we got a new Seth Rogen movie. It came out, and then it was just like it never came out.
He was in everything, and now he's in hardly anything. You know, the Apatow brand has completely died.
I think a supreme being may exist because his career has gone nowhere.
Yeah, as it should. I mean, it's terrible that he ever got anywhere.
He's a terrible no talent that grew up in the industry and just, you know, for whatever reason, was given a lot of opportunity to be awful in films.
Yes.
I remember when Knocked Up came out and I saw the poster and was like, they gave that ugly guy from the 40-Year-Old Virgin a movie? What?
Yeah, he's supposed to be the 5-minute co-worker wise guy that you only see for like 5 minutes.
And remember, he was the bully in Donnie Darko? He was just
God, I forgot.
Yeah, he was the
I totally forgot.
Shit. Yeah, the best movie he starred in was Observe and Report. Yes. And I think that movie would have been even better if it actually starred Danny McBride instead of Seth Rogen.
It's clearly written for Danny McBride.
That was his best movie. And because it's not Seth Rogen doing Seth Rogen in the film.
No. He actually, because I was talking to someone about this the other day. I go, it's his best movie because he had really no creative input into it.
Yeah.
You know, there was Jonah Hill, not Jonah Hill. Jody Hill and Danny McBride. You know, it's their movie.
Yep, because it was that was the first movie they did after Foot Fist Way, right?
Yeah, and I think it was after Eastbound and Down the first.
Yeah,
season. Yeah.
And that was when Danny
negative reaction comparable to Mallrats.
Man, Danny McBride. That was when he was super high in demand and in everything too. But I think Danny McBride's. You know, he does the same shtick, but he's actually funny. I don't know.
Yeah, like what was great was in you know, Vice Principals. He was a little bit like Kenny Powers, but he was kind of like a kinder, gentler Kenny Powers in Vice Principals.
Vice Principals is hilarious, and the reason I think it's hilarious is it's one of those movies. If you've ever been a teacher, you know, it's even funnier.
And also, Walton Goggins on that show is fantastic.
Yeah,
it's fantastic. Even overshadows over Danny McBride. That's how good he is in it.
He really does. And if you've ever taught, you've met like 100 dudes like that. I mean,
yeah, Vice Principals is amazing.
Yeah,
never seen it.
Do you want to circle back to 1994 comedies?
Yes.
Sure.
Yes. Very quickly.
Let's circle back. Circle back.
We got Milk Money.
Ooh!
Oh!
Dude! I saw the soundtrack. I saw the soundtrack on vinyl the other day.
Fuck Melanie Griffith?
That's the one where she's a prostitute, yeah.
Yeah, kid fucker.
I remember I only knew that film because it was a trailer on my rental copy of some stupid sea lion movie where the sea lion befriends a little girl. I think it's called My Friend Andre or some shit.
Oh, yeah,
like that.
You're thinking of My Dinner with Andre.
with Andre.
Seal at the dinner table. He like eats like the lasagna.
Yeah, and it doesn't get good until they start talking about real shit as opposed to fantasy bullshit about gnomes and things from Ireland.
Yeah. Is it the Secret of Rowan and Ish? Do you remember that one? Secret of Rowan and Ish?
I do, yeah. Here's a movie that nobody has thought about since 94.
but somehow that guy got hired to rewrite Eric and Malloy's script.
Yeah.
Yes.
Movie.
He did, Yeah. Questionable choices he's made in that script, but that's okay. I got you know, there's no minors in 1915. I'm sorry, but anyways, Beverly. This is John's favorite movie of 1994. Beverly Hills Cop 3.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
I actually tried watching that about 2 years ago on Netflix. I could only get like 40 minutes into it, and I had to stop. I'm like, this is fucking awful. It is even worse than I remember it.
I decided to crash the helicopter into the stop button.
If you're an amusement park head, then you might get something out of it. at the end of Mallrats, when London and the girl get married, and it says they're in Universal Studios Florida, that's not Universal Studios Florida. That's Hollywood. You
know, oh, that's is Hollywood. That? Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I've never been to either one, so I just took its word for it.
Mixed Nuts with Steve Martin, 1994.
Nora Ephron did that.
I think that was a huge bomb too when it came out.
It smells like one.
Yeah. I don't remember it at all.
These mixed nuts.
I saw City Slickers 2. I don't know why in the theater. My mom took me. Did she see the first one? I have no idea.
Legend
Can't get
of
any.
Curly's Gold.
Curly's Gold. Yeah.
Yeah, Mixnuts bombed. It only made $6.8 million.
There you go. Quite a few, but nothing. Wolf with Jack Nicholson.
Oh yeah, yeah. The werewolf movie where he doesn't turn into a werewolf.
Yeah, I thought that was earlier.
I thought it was too, but it might. It sounds about that time.
You know what's funny is that they were when Wolf was coming out. They were having a Fangoria Weekend of Horrors in California, and I was working at it for the poster store I was at, and it was like Jack Nicholson's gonna be here, and then basically, you know, I heard he went out for like 5 minutes, said a couple of things, and then left, and everyone at the convention was like super fucking pissed off.
I don't want to hang out with you nerds.
What do you expect of Jack Nicholson? I mean, you think he's going to stay in a Fangoria Weekend of Horrors?
I was promised some young co-eds here.
Were the Lakers playing that day? Were the Lakers playing?
That's maybe. Going to indicate could have been.
Yeah. At the time, were girls into horror?
No.
Not
so
really.
That's why he left. Yeah, there you
they
go.
Like Freddy Krueger, and they like Dr. Giggles, and that was about it.
Dr. Giggles?
terrible date with a girlfriend where she went to watch Dr. Giggles. I was about to go nuts. I was just like, Jesus Christ.
There was another, besides Mallrats, there was another stoner comedy in 94.
Hold on.
What? Is next movie Dr. Giggles?
Yes.
Was it?
It has to be now.
Was it Half-Baked? Or was that later?
No,
that was 1997 or 8. Oh, I think 1998.
Something called The Stone Age. The Stone Age.
That did not get a theatrical release, or not in my region of the country.
Not in mine either.
Yeah. That was like straight to video. I'm pretty sure that was like dumped on video.
It might have paid like two theaters in like Arkansas or something.
Yeah, Test Market in Chicago or Sacramento, California.
I wonder if Mallrats played Miami. I doubt it.
I think it played everywhere. It was a pretty big release.
Yeah, it got a big release. Yeah.
It was a pretty big flop too.
He goes, I asked Jim Jacks, Kevin Smith said, I asked Jim Jacks, how'd we do? Like when he called for the box office numbers, we did about 400,000 on which screen? That's in the whole country.
He should have pulled a Norm MacDonald and said, you know how much money that is? $400,000? Hey, $400,000, come on.
Yeah, I could make one Chasing Amy with that, 1.5. Yeah.
Could holding that in your hands, how much money that is? It's heavy.
Now, Dirty Work is actually one of the better 90s comedies.
Oh, Dirty Work's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the Saigon whore that bit my nose off.
And that was a bomb too, but that one I felt like really hurt by it bombing because I actually felt it was a really good movie.
Yeah, it was really good.
Well, they got all those movies got like, you know, Mallrats and Dirty Work. I think got a second life on video rental.
Yeah. Although Dirty Work did way better than Mallrats. Dirty Work made $10 million.
Okay.
Yeah, Mallrats made like two.
Yeah.
Well, it's because Norm had the SNL push, because back then SNL had pretty strong ratings.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas nowadays, a million people can watch it, and they'll justify keeping it on the air.
Yeah, there wasn't really anything for, you know, with Mallrats, what would draw you in? You know, there's no big comedy star.
And it was literally just people who liked Clerks who went to go see it.
Yeah.
It's funny you bring up Clerks as compared to something like that Ben Stiller movie that I have not seen.
Reality Bites.
And it's like I remember that Clerks was something that was promoted as you had to see it in a theater because they did not run a lot of ads on TV. They did not run tie-in music videos. They didn't have the two lead actors, you know, take over MTV for several hours. It in no way was promoted like in your face all the time. It was almost like, hey, you got to go see this at a theater, this little black and white indie. It was never like, you got to see this, man. It speaks for the generation. And it wasn't promoted in magazines like crazy. It was just kind of a slow growth back when the Weinsteins were really good at, you know, pushing a cheap but effective type of indie release like that, you know, by newspaper ads. It changed every week and were kind of smart alecky and stuff like, or it was still in theaters in October, and they had like the cast with like vampire fangs on them and capes and stuff. You know, they would just alter the advertising every week. Like, I can't think of a time when anything has been pushed in a theater like that, like since then.
Yeah, it's basically, it's all about the opening weekend now, and that's it, you know?
Yeah.
Well, now it's nothing. Yeah. Now it's stay at home and hope people click on your movie.
Yeah, it's just throw it up on streaming and hope people subscribe to watch it. You know,
if you don't feel like paying for it, you just go to Pirate Bay and, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like, do they, you never hear about like, oh, this one did really well on Blu-ray. Like, nobody, only weirdos like us have Blu-rays, you know?
Yes.
And also, that's the other thing that hurt Kevin Smith is basically when Kevin Smith movies would come out, they would do okay at the theater. So like, basically they would do anywhere between like, you know, his later ones, like, I think Chasing Amy did like 12 million. Dogma did like, I think 30, you know, and Clerks 2 did like 24 million. But the reason his people would still like give him money and stuff was his movies did extremely well on DVD and DVD. Like, they would sell hugely on DVD, and that's why they would put them on the theaters and stuff like that. If they took a little loss in the theaters, they would make all that money back and then some on DVD. But the problem is, there's no DVD Blu-ray market anymore. No one buys shit anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, literally only collectors buy that, and that those group of people are growing smaller and smaller every fucking week.
Oh,
so
when I tell my students, like, you know, they'll go, oh, is this movie streaming anywhere? And I'll say, well, you know, you have to, it's not streaming for free anywhere, but you know, you can rent it or on digitally, or you can get the Blu-ray, or I may as well, if that's my response, I might as well have told them it burned up in the Universal fire and you can't watch it.
Yeah. Yeah, Jerry Lewis
has it in his vault.
Yeah, so basically, Kevin Smith doesn't have that huge DVD, you know, money anymore, and that's why, you know, I think a lot of his stuff goes, you know, is just like roadshow type stuff now, and that's how he makes his money, because the DVD money's not there anymore.
Yeah, and it's honestly, it's a smart way to try to do it, you know, because it gives you have a direct line to the fans. You sell them an experience going to see it and talking about it and hanging out, you know. It's one way to survive as a filmmaker, in terms of putting on a show, you know.
Do you remember about probably 13, whenever Red State came out, because I think this happened for Red State, that he claimed that he was going to start a production company, or rather a distribution company?
I don't remember that. No.
Like, it wasn't a production company, so he couldn't make a film, but it was a distribution company where he was going to let the little guy, if they were to make a movie or something, be distributed through
that. Yeah, you know what? He did do that, and you know how I know? Because I worked on a movie that he distributed.
So it actually did, actually. Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Right, so it happened.
Yeah, a movie I worked on. We were going to do a show on it, but something happened. I can't remember what. But we were going to do it, a movie I worked on that I actually did a lot of work for. It's probably the movie I, you know, did probably have the best memories of working on. It's a movie called Losers Take All. And his company, Kevin Smith's Movie Club, picked it up and distributed it.
All right. So it's an actual thing that happened. Okay.
Yes, it did happen. It did happen.
I trust it, and I never heard about it ever again.
Yeah, but they put out Losers Take All, so go check that out. My name's in the credits.
Yeah, but I don't think it lasted long, because there's really no money in distributing movies anymore.
No.
You know?
And honestly, I think the business model was kind of Lloyd Kaufman-esque. It was like, basically, just give us the movie and, you know.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of how I think it was that sort of model. I could be wrong, but it just sort of seemed like it was the lowest cost possible for distribution.
Speaking of Red State, we didn't talk about it.
It's a weird movie. I just remember watching it and thinking Kevin Smith shouldn't make political movies, because I have no clue who he's mad at. When I watch it, is he mad at Feld Phelps? Yeah. Is he mad at the government? I don't know who he's mad at.
I was kind of happy for him, because he brought in his scope a little bit, but it's not a good movie, no.
Yeah, I basically remember watching it, and I can barely remember anything about it. It did not stick with me at all.
I liked Tusk more than I liked Red State.
I didn't like Tusk.
Yeah, which, you know, and I'm not saying it's a good movie, but it was totally weird. But it has these long. It's one of those movies that has really long scenes that go nowhere. But as a concept, I was like, that's a very bizarre film. But Red State, you know, it had some interesting performances and it did some interesting things. But it's a political movie that I have no clue who or what, or I don't know what it's saying. Like it's because Kevin Smith he's just not good at that. He's not a political commentator, and he's just repeating things other people tell him, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cause it starts out and you have this kind of Fred Phelps like cult killing gay people, but then they get raided in this Waco like way that seems monstrous and horrible on the part of the government. And you're going, wait, what? I'm confused.
And he's not talented enough to make a political movie by mistake, like Quentin's Hollywood movie.
Exactly, exactly. That's a really good comparison, actually. But circling back to Mallrats.
Oh yeah, circle back.
I don't know anything you guys want to add. So circle back around. Yeah,
is this the only one with nudity of the VSQ universe? Is this the only one that I?
Yeah, it was. Okay. And I remember in the commentary, Kevin said he didn't like doing nudity. He said that he felt uncomfortable on the set and he didn't really like it. But I know he did do nudity in Zack and Miri. I think did that have nudity in it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but like View Askew has to have Jay and Bob, or it's not a View Askew movie.
Yeah, well, right. I'm not saying that's not a View Askew movie, but I was just saying he's done nudity since.
But, nudity, okay.
But as far as this Askew, I think that's the only one. And I remember in the commentary him saying, because his commentary tracks were a lot of fun. It was like him like hanging out with people.
Yeah.
It was really cool. It was great.
They were a laugh riot. Yeah.
There was just him and the people that just hanging out, watching the film and having fun. I remember that was when I got into commentaries, cause I was like, wow, you know, these can be really cool. But he said that, doing nudity was just, you know, he said he liked the idea of making like a titty comedy, but, he said he didn't enjoy actually shooting it, which is weird. Cause he did, didn't he shoot a Playboy shoot for his wife later?
I think he might have. Yeah.
Yeah.
He did?
Yeah.
Oh, the one that was in Clerks 2?
Yeah.
Yeah. Schwalbach.
Oh, my God. Oh, God. Jesus Christ. There goes one of our iTunes views. We're going to have a negative one now. It's like maybe more comfortable with judging by what he and his. Maybe she done male nudity or something for him.
Oh, yeah. I kind of wonder because Kevin seems like the kind of guy who Googles his stuff and checks out what people are saying about it.
It gets more embarrassing because I'm looking at the pictures now. It's her in
what?
It's her in lingerie with Superman. Some guy.
Oh no!
Yes! Yes! Yes!
Oh, yep.
God! God damn my eyes, my imagination.
You got to post these up for the banner of the show.
Oh. Going to Bing right now. Gonna regret this.
Yeah. We have to hear John's reaction in real time.
All right. Let's see what Bing Images pulls up. Uh-oh. It's blurring on the highlights. Let's see. Oh, dear God. Not good. Nah. Is that what I'm really seeing? Is he trying to make her look like Margot Kidder? Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Oh, it's bad. This is not good.
Yeah.
No. This is really bad. Oh, my God.
That's and of course, terrible. He'd let some guy dressed up as Superman fondle his wife.
Yes.
While he takes pictures. Of course he would.
I wonder if his wife. I wonder if he's there into cuck holding.
Well, I mean, if she's making him, if he's talking about.
I bet he is.
I mean, you know, that's kind of cuckoldry right there, you know, in a
yeah,
way.
Yeah, I mean, it's a Playboy shoot. She doesn't, there doesn't have to be a dude in the pictures with her, you know?
That was, you know, it's actually very rare that you have dudes in Playboy shoots. It's supposed right. to be for straight men.
It was a deliberate choice by her husband to have a guy dressed as Superman.
Something to show Batman your kids. Something to show the kids one day.
I'm trying to find something more direct because Bing is kind of hiding it. This only has that one shot coming up. Maybe that's the only one that's out
be.
On the web.
It might be. I don't know.
Or I got to go to DuckDuckGo.
I can just send it to you.
It's not good. This is repulsive. Okay, yeah. You just Jesus Christ.
This is some
gay Superman model in like loose fitting Supes pajamas molesting his wife. That's wonderful.
Oh, this is where comic book.
There
goes.
There's a negative iTunes review right yeah. there. Negative iTunes.
This
I
is where
sense at these jerks.
This is where comic book fandom leads, ladies and gentlemen.
Is this our little boy's treehouse that you know? Give us 2 rating on iTunes.
Oh shit!
And woman haters.
Oh, man. Well, guys. So I want to hear what you would rate Mallrats. Garrow, I want to hear you first. What would you rate Mallrats?
Okay, in 1995, it was a 9. I would have given it a 9. In what year are we in? 2021?
Yeah, some I lost count.
Yeah. 2021, I give it a 6.5. I still enjoyed it. Not as funny as it was in 1995. The bad acting really got to me this time. Jason Lee steals the movie as he did in 1995. He's really you know how like Christoph Waltz is like really good at Tarantino dialogue? It's like Jason Lee is Kevin Smith, Christoph Waltz, you know,
yeah.
he's just fantastic with it, you know, and he makes the movie. If Jason Lee wasn't in the movie, I don't think we'd still be talking about Mallrats, you know, all these years later. I think it would have been. Yeah, I think he really makes the movie and sells it outside, you know, but other than that, I mean, I think it's fun. I think it's probably his second best movie after Clerks, in my opinion. Although I'd probably have to watch Jane, Silent Bob Strike Back again just to see where that would land. But yeah, I mean, basically it's either his second or third best movie. Not as good as 1995, but it's still better than anything he's made in like 20, 30 years. So.
Yeah, I agree with you there. It's the movie of his. I think it's one of the most watchable. You know, I have fond memories of it from when I was younger. So gives it some pull for me. I'd give it a 7. So, you know, a little bit higher than you. Mm-hmm. What about, John, what would you give it?
In 95, I probably would give it a 7. I remember I got some big laughs out of it back then because I watched the extended cut. And, you know, comparing it to my memories. Yeah, the extended cut, by the way, it gets a 2 from me. It's bad. I would give the theatrical cut probably in reassessment, I would say probably a 5. I don't hate the film, but it's. It doesn't hold up. It hasn't aged well, and I don't admire him, and he's not in my top 1,000 favorite directors. And by the way, I give the photo of his wife with the Superman model in Playboy probably a -7. But just because what it's going to do to my psyche now that I've seen this. Eric actually sent me a higher res pic. It's not good.
Well, at least we know what to get.
She should have been a finger cuffs with Blunt Man and Chronic.
Oh, no.
Why didn't he think of that?
So gross. All right, Eric, what would you give it?
If this has been reappraised as one of his better movies, then the other ones that I have fond memories of, I will leave only to memory. I'll never watch them ever again. I'm giving this 3.
Oh, ouch. by the way, the guy who plays LaFleur's, Sven Ole Thorsen, that guy's been in a ton of action movies. Like, a ton.
Yeah, he's one of Schwarzenegger's buddies.
Yeah, he's in so much stuff. Like, he's in, like, all the Lethal Weapon movies. He's in all the Conan movies. He's in, like, Predator, running, like, just all kinds of stuff. Like, Abraxas.
Yeah.
Hunt for Red October. Just on deadly ground.
Predator. There's such a limited amount of people.
Oh, there's not very. He's. It says Russian officer.
What?
I think he was one of the dudes who gets killed at the camp. I don't know.
Okay. Knock, knock.
Yeah. Stick around. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, he was in George of the Jungle. There's a 90s comedy for you.
He's probably very wealthy because he's probably very. He can apply his look to a lot of different roles.
Yeah.
Because I've seen him in so many things.
The Quick
George of
the
Jungle has a cult following, the movie.
One of my buddies, one of his teachers in school was the director of George of the Jungle, and he was not a film student.
Hilarious.
Sam Wiseman. He also did D2, The Mighty Ducks 2, and Dickie Roberts, former child star. But yeah, this guy was like a teacher at some college, but he taught like economics or something. Like, he wasn't a film teacher.
Weird. This guy
I don't know. This guy was my buddy was in business school, but he was like, it was like at a boarding school or something. He was in Britain or something, you know, or New York.
So he's like a Herschel Gordon Lewis.
Oh no, you know what? It was at Deerfield Academy. It was at Deerfield Academy because my buddy went to Deerfield and he was one of the teachers there. So yeah, it was a boarding school for boys. Yeah,
he did 3 episodes of Moonlighting.
Yeah.
He was a TV director mostly.
Yeah, he did a lot of TV. Family Ties.
TV, his first feature, unless I'm missing one, is George of the Jungle.
Yeah. Yeah, he did George of the Jungle, D2 the Mighty, D2 the Mighty Ducks he did before that.
Oh, that came first. You're right. Yeah. I missed it. Yeah.
Yeah, The Out of Towners.
Something called Bye Bye Love.
He did an episode of The Bernie Mac Show.
Yeah, I'm looking at that here.
Oh,
what's weird is I just realized I rated Mallrats the same as I rated the Death Wish remake with Bruce Willis. That means it's probably a worse movie. Like, it's probably much worse than I rated it.
The way
I rated Death Wish way too high.
The way I look at the rating system is you have to kind of rate it for the kind of movie that it is. Otherwise, you're going to find yourself doubling back or circling back, if you will.
Yeah, you'll circle back and you'll go, well, I rated it. I rated it the same as this other type of movie, and you just can't do that.
Yeah, it's hard to resist because I'm like, oh god, it's probably worse than I'm giving it. I'm probably just trying to be nice because I've made fun of his wife's Playboy shoot.
And Anon 88 is going to show up and go like, hey, John, you rated this movie a three, but are you saying that's worse than Death Wish 5, Kiss of Death?
Yeah. I'll rate Death Wish 4 higher than either film. I'll put it that way.
When you make fun of the photo shoot, you're not really making fun of his wife. You're making fun of Kevin because it was his choice to do that.
Yes. Yeah, it was. It was a ridiculous choice.
Yeah, it's embarrassing. Yeah, it's bad.
Yeah.
Well, anything to add about Mallrats before we go, guys? Kevin Smith, anything we need to circle back to?
Well, I stopped following him on Twitter a couple of months ago. I just felt like, why am I doing this?
He got tired of the crying.
Yeah.
His post the other day about how some guy made fun of him on his run for wearing 2 masks was pretty hilarious. But
I hoped he'd run into a serial killer.
Yeah. It was the definition of a self-own.
Oh, it really was. He self-owns a lot on social media. It's so weird. I've never seen a guy do it as often as he does.
Do you realize how fucking Chad that Howard Hawks was in comparison to how these guys are today?
Oh, oh my gosh, Howard Hawks.
Just like an old man with a bunch of young women and sort of draped around his house, basically.
I mean, film directors used to be tank commanders, and now they're just comic book geeks and video store nerds. That's all they
are. They used to be guys who went on safaris and, man, you know, Elias feel hippie.
Go read about Sam Spiegel, the guy who produced all the greatest movies ever made. Like, that guy was an international criminal. he produced like The African Queen. He produced Lawrence of Arabia. He produced On the Waterfront, Bridge on the River Kwai, The Swimmer. You know, that guy was just that guy. But you read about him and it's like he's like the world's most interesting man, you know.
He was a jewel thief. He was a diamond smuggler.
I mean, yeah, it's insane. When you read about him, you go, my goodness.
He evaded the Paris police in a rooftop chase.
No, yeah, he is just a like, you're like, man, you know what? We need more guys like this making movies. But
yeah, definitely.
It's
Kevin Smith. Kevin Smith had his like time. He was good for a certain amount of time, and now he just has like, you know, like a million people who love him and will follow him everywhere, and that's how he can make his money. But I think it's that.
And you know, good on him. That's kind of the life cycle. If you can get in that position, you're in the lucky club, you know?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Had he stopped at Jay and Bob, the first one, and pretty much just retired from public life, I wonder if we would reassess his career as a pretty good one today.
Yeah.
Probably.
Oh, yeah.
Or had he gone to television like a lot of those 90s guys did.
He actually did. He actually does go to television. He actually directs episodes of the Goldbergs, WB DC shows. He directs episodes of that, you know. So he does do that. He does make money doing that. But, you know, it's you know, but that's just work for hire stuff, you know. And I'm sure you do. Yeah.
And he I didn't hate his work on some comics, you know. There were some comics he wrote that I thought weren't bad for Daredevil and stuff like that.
Well, he has an affinity for that stuff. So,
yeah, like, sure. he did this Daredevil book that I thought was pretty good. I mean, it was a pretty dark, freaky. I remember picking it up. I went, Kevin Smith wrote this, and I picked it up, and it was not funny. It was a pretty intense Daredevil book, and the Ben Affleck movie kind of took a few images from the artwork from it. But
wasn't he a writer on that?
No, he was.
No,
in
he just
it.
Put a cameo.
Yeah,
in it,
he was in it, and it definitely nicked a few things from his story in terms of the visuals, not the plot. But, he did, and he did some Spider-Man, Black Cat comics and stuff like that. I have a few that are signed by him. I didn't hate the stuff he did with comics. You know, he's been able to parlay his career into a lot of different, he's got put a lot of different irons in the fire, and good for him. He's got his little cult, and it's like a band, you know, you're big for a minute, and then you just kind of persist off the diehards, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think we're going to see another, you know, released by him movie wise. I don't think it's gonna happen. I think the days of that are over.
And with any luck, I hope Rob Zombie doesn't get a movie at all ever again.
Yeah. I'd rather watch a Kevin Smith movie than a Rob Zombie movie. I'm telling you.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Thankfully it looks like Rob is making albums pretty consistently now, which means fewer movies. So that's good.
Yeah,
he Kevin, knows that's done. That
I remember when he announced the Groucho Marx biopic like 7 years ago. Like,
the only person who should be playing Groucho Marx is Gilbert Gottfried. That's the only person.
Not a bad casting choice, actually.
Have you ever heard his Groucho impressions on the Stern Show? They were hysterical.
Oh, his old Groucho on Anthony Cumia.
Yeah,
I nearly pissed myself. It was so funny. Garo, do you have anything to plug, sir?
Well, Dangerous People is out on Tubi. You can watch it there. You can buy the DVD and Blu-ray and hear Hunter Deucing you know, on the commentary track.
Oh yeah, and you know, we got a lot of I don't want to brag, but we got a lot of good feedback on that commentary track. A lot of people liked it. Eric What about you? I know you got your YouTube channel.
Got the YouTube channel. It's my name, Eric Zaldivar. I don't know. Join me on Twitter. I don't do much on there. But you get updates on my channel, my other channel, YouTube. So that's about it.
I'll plug something. You worked on a movie that Mike Malloy directed called Eurocrime. Go watch that.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Go watch that.
Good movie. And John, you want to talk about stuff Stu's been doing?
He does these little short, very interesting and entertaining little podcasts between our shows, little mini episodes where for about 25 minutes he's talking about what he's digging from his garage. And so he's very, very enthusiastic. And his show about the Friday the 13th box, it's a fun listen. I can't stand those films, but it was fun to listen to Stu talk about their positives and negatives and reasons to buy the podcast, or I mean buy the box set even if you don't like the film. So it was fun.
Yeah,
keep up with Stu that way.
When is that documentary on the Friday the 13th movies of the sequels that never were? When is that going to happen?
Oh, ooh. That would be fun.
Yeah, that would be fun.
That's not a thing? I thought that was a thing.
Maybe it is. I don't know.
I'm still going through Crystal Lake Memories or whatever, the 2-disc, like 6-hour document. Right. I don't even like those films, but it is a fascinating watch.
Oh, you liked it. I saw it years ago. Is this the one where is this the one where Jason Mewes shows up and says he was not? There's the confusion.
No. This is a different. This is a new one.
Because that one was lazy and terrible.
That was his name was Jason, I think. This is a more exhaustive. It talks to the screenwriter of Friday the 13th Part 2 and 3, guy who passed away like a year ago. It talks to a lot of people involved. It talks to set decorators. They go back to the locations where they shot them because the first few were filmed in the Northeast and some interesting locations. You know, there's a little more like regional filmmaking, which is yeah. It was like we forget that there was like camps out in New York and New Jersey they could film these things in. So far I'm up to like part 4 and it's pretty fascinating. And unfortunately Corey Feldman is hosting it, but it's tolerable. And it's well worth watching. I think it was only like $10 from Amazon, so it's like I don't regret the purchase. And like I said, I'm not a fan.
Yeah, no, I don't like those films either. But I'm for whatever reason I'm just fascinated by movies that never were.
Yeah.
And you know, or even I'm actually pretty fascinated by the behind the scenes stories of that particular series.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting, and I'm hoping they'll talk about the proposed Cheech and Chong Meet Jason.
That the
director of Part 6 actually pitched to him.
Yeah, they should have gone that route. They really should.
They should have. It would have been better than Takes Manhattan or you know, whatever else they did with that series.
Whenever they had an okay idea, they futzed it up. Carrie versus Jason, like that stuff. Yeah, it sounds great in theory, and then in practice, it's 10 minutes of okay shit at the end.
But you know what? Freddy versus Jason was awesome.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah,
I love that.
Yeah, and they got a good director for it.
And they have a role that should have been played by Jason Mewes in the movie.
I think it was written for him, but they couldn't get him for some reason, or you know, he was in
rehab.
Messed
up on drugs. Drugs.
Yeah. And Freddy versus Jason, I saw in Hialeah, Florida, which is a kind of a suburb of Miami. And it was mostly a black theater, and it was one of the best experience in a movie theater I've ever had in my life.
Yeah,
easily.
Yeah. That's the best place to see that kind of movie.
You had one group of people who were for Jason and the other group of people were for a child molester. It was fantastic.
one of the best responses I've ever had seeing a movie in a movie theater was when I saw Jason Goes to Hell, and basically the end of the last scene in the movie is, you know, Jason's mask, and then Freddy's claw comes up and grabs the mask, and the whole audience freaked out. Like, people were freaking out in the theater, like, oh my god, yeah, they went frigging ape shit over the fucking glove grabbing the thing, and that was definitely a high Kino moment for me.
Do they dance in the aisles like in Showtime at the Apollo?
No. It didn't go that far. Came close.
Death comedy jam.
Oh my gosh. Oh,
Why don't we get those movies in the theaters still?
I know.
The last time I saw anything close to that reaction was when Jason Statham popped up at the end of that Fast and Furious movie as the one who just killed.
Oh.
That got a surprise reaction. Like, I was with an audience that didn't read the internet all the time.
Well, anything else to plug, guys?
Next week, Dr. Giggles?
Yes, Dr. Giggles. For sure. With Durant from Darkman. Yes.
Yep.
Or
some people say the retad from LA Law.
Oh. All right, guys. Well, with that, I'm going to go ahead and say adios.
Yeah, I'll say peace out.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to Facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.